From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
China and the legacy of the Olympic Games. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Starting Friday, the world may start focusing on Olympic athletics, but the host country will never be out of the spotlight. China has blocked the internet, cracked down on dissidents, and after 3 days of blue skies, Beijing is under another blanket of smog. On To the Point, China's accused of breaking promises and tarnishing the legacy of the Games. But are the Olympics a sure path from despotism to democracy? We'll look at what China does not want us to see, as well as what's on display, including architecture that rivals the Forbidden City and the Great Wall. On Reporter's Notebook later on, should the case of the anthrax letters be closed? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney back with To the Point. The promise of the Beijing Olympics was a healthier, freer, more open society. But with the Games about to get underway, the world is seeing smog, the roundup of dissidents, and a crackdown on the internet. On To the Point, has China broken its promises, or was it subject to unrealistic expectations? On Reporter's Notebook, the FBI reportedly wants to close the case of the anthrax letters now that the main suspect has committed suicide. Is all the evidence in? Should there be more public disclosure? First, this news update. At the south coast of Texas is cleaning up after Hurricane Dolly. The southwestern coast, southeastern coast, and part of Louisiana are threatened by Tropical Storm Edward. At the same time, Dallas is experiencing record temperatures. Gene Haffel is meteorologist in charge at the Houston Galveston office of the National Weather Service. Gene Haffel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you bet.
Let's start talking about Edward. Just a blip on the radar last week. All of a sudden, it may turn into a hurricane.
Well, it definitely is a well-organized tropical storm this afternoon, and we are expecting further strengthening, and it's expected to become at least a strong tropical storm, if not maybe a minimal Category 1 hurricane, before it makes landfall on Tuesday morning.
Is it growing unusually fast?
Well, no, it's kind of a steady pace, but you know, it kind of formed up fairly rapidly yesterday, and pretty much following kind of the plan that was outlined by the Hurricane Center, but continues to strengthen slowly, and we expect further strengthening in the next 24 hours.
I understand the Houston Ship Channel has been closed to traffic. The oil companies are getting the offshore drilling platforms ready. Do you know what sort of preparations they require?
You mean on the offshore? Mainly offshore platforms. It's more just evacuating.
Get them off there.
Getting the people off the platforms and stuff like that. And the main thing with the ship channel is they try to, you know, eliminate any traffic that would take place during the onset of the storm. So they're trying to get whatever boats they need to get out of there, you know, have an opportunity to get out. The others are going to have to stay put.
What's it been like so far around Houston and Galveston?
Well, today it's a fairly nice day, kind of warm outside, and, fairly sunshiny, a good day to go to the beach, even though Tropical Storm Edward is sitting offshore.
Go to the beach, but get away from it by tomorrow morning.
Exactly. Yeah, people really should be, you know, today should be kind of a day of getting ready for the storm. The main impact of the storm is going to be heavy rain, some tidal problems right along the immediate coast, and also strong wind. So we're encouraging people to pick up items that can be picked up and become missiles of destruction, fill their cars up with gas in case they do have to travel, and especially if you live down near the coast, you might even board up your windows and stuff like that to protect yourself from the flying debris that will be picked up by the nearly hurricane-force winds when it makes landfall.
When you talk about weather, you're talking about weather. Again, this is Gene Haffel, who's meteorologist in charge of the Houston-Galveston National Weather Service office. Well, what about all these high temperatures in Dallas and that region of Texas? Do they have anything to do with Edward?
Well, no, unfortunately, they're not really related, per se. To an, to a small degree, they might be related. It just so happens that, you know, hot weather occurs in August in Texas, and so do hurricanes, you know. So we just happen to have, you know, both of them going on at the same time. But main cause of the hot weather is basically a very large ridge of high pressure centered over the area, which basically causes the atmosphere or the air to kind of sink. And when the air sinks, it heats up, okay? And also, you mentioned the storm. Quite often when there is a storm, you know, around the periphery outside of the storm, it also generates some sinking air. So to a degree, the storm is having some influence on the hot weather in other parts of Texas.
Does the does it make the hot weather get hotter or cooler?
Yeah, it actually makes the hot weather get hotter when you're, you know, away from the storm, because it causes additional sinking of the atmosphere, which actually heats up the air. So it's not unusual. A good example of that is a couple of years ago when we had Hurricane Rita, and we had all the evacuations. There was extreme heat during that event, and which added to the problems of that evacuation. And that was caused by the, you know, the sinking of the air around the edge of the storm.
Big time increase in the use of power.
Yeah, I'm sure there is a big increase in the use of power. Of course, you know, hot weather in Texas in August are a fairly common event.
And humidity as well.
Exactly, especially here along the Texas Gulf Coast. Dew points in the mid-70s is something that we get used to every year.
Okay, well, we'll see whether you can get used to this and how big Eduardo gets, or Edward, rather. And thanks very much for talking with us.
All right, you bet. Have a good day.
You too. Gene Haffel again, meteorologist in charge at the Houston Galveston National Weather Service office. In a moment, China and the legacy of the Olympic Games on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. 7 years ago, the Secretary General of the Beijing Olympic Bid Committee said this summer's games would not only promote our economy, but also enhance all social conditions, including education, health, and human rights. But just 4 days before the games will get underway, China is accused of breaking its promises to clean the air, relax controls on political dissidents, and open up to the Western media. One sports historian says nobody should have believed those promises in the first place. He is Professor John Hoberman at the University of Texas at Austin. He's author of an article in the current Foreign Policy magazine entitled The Olympic Myth, Why the Olympics May Do More Harm Than Good. Professor Hoberman, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is a strong question that you're asking with a lot of implications based on the history of the games as you see them. We're really talking about China today, but briefly, if you can, what does the history of the games show?
I think the most comparable Olympiad to this one would be Moscow 1980, where you have a communist dictatorship, you have an expected flood of, at that time, 300,000 Western tourists were supposed to show up. There are expectations of a liberalizing effect on Soviet society, but it did not turn out that way. The KGB locked up the city. One reporter told me he had the impression that even people with physical deformities had been taken off the streets. The dissidents were told to get out of town and stay out until the games were over, and it was a very tightly run affair. The analogy, of course, is not perfect. The Soviet Union was not a dynamic state. As an economic player, it didn't even count compared to the Chinese today. What we are seeing is a tremendous effort, according to reports, to create an impenetrable police presence, three checkpoints around Beijing just to get into the city. The petitioners with their political complaints are being turned away. The terrorist threat is being evoked in order to justify this tremendous police effort to keep things absolutely under control. And in this sense, I suppose the interests of the IOC coincide with those of the Chinese regime. The IOC president said he wants magical games, unquote, that are going to make us forget all about the politics.
So it's the position of the IOC that politics has no role in the games.
The IOC president will actually say something that implausible, as he has in recent months, from time to time. Back in April, he said it was politics that invited themselves into the games. The games never invited them. Surely he knows better than that. But for whatever reason, IOC presidents have long felt compelled to talk out both sides of their mouths. On the one hand, the games are some sort of sacrosanct activity that should enjoy immunity for politics. By the same token, the IOC leadership will claim that the Olympic movement is a peace movement, that it is politically creative and liberalizing, et cetera. So they want to have it both ways.
What about the attack today by on the police in the western part of China by the Uyghurs, the Muslim group there, which is one of the dissident groups? Does that help to bolster the Chinese claim that terrorism of various kinds is a real threat?
Sure it does. And they've been talking about precisely that dissident threat for weeks now.
So then they're not entirely, that's not implausible. I mean, they're not making that up.
Unless the Secret Service decided to stage something in order to justify this enormous police control of the entire area. I mean, I haven't seen that report, and I think that we would all do well to take it perhaps with a grain of salt until there is more thorough reporting on it.
When you go back to Moscow and other cities that have had the Olympics, I guess Seoul, South Korea, is the best example of an Olympics that did in fact lead to liberalization of a country. But even in Moscow, was there some sort of delayed effect, do you think, by all the attention that was given and all the disappointment that was expressed?
I would not say so. Olympics create a tremendous amount of publicity and attention in the run-up, as we are seeing, and this is an incredibly dramatic Olympic year in that respect, and, of course, during the Games. Hopefully what we are witnessing is sports drama rather than any sort of violent attacks. But the point is that the Games are going to be seen as political one way or another, regardless of whether you have violent incidents or not.
So they are inevitably political, is what you're saying?
Yes, they are, because in one scenario, you have an international arrangement for facilitating nationalistic competition between nations. Every time the IOC goes into business with an authoritarian regime, as it has this year, it is feeding the potential for that regime to justify itself domestically, as the Chinese are certainly doing now, and to, in effect, create bragging rights to the rest of the world. The Chinese regime, in its determination to put on a perfect spectacle and perfectly controlled Olympic Games, is sending a message to the domestic population about its own competence and its own ability to represent Chinese civilization in a dramatic and positive way. Of course, it is also the cherry on the top of the cake when it comes to the Chinese, incredible Chinese accomplishments in the area of economic globalization.
John Hoberman, again, is a professor of Germanic Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Recently wrote an article in Foreign Policy magazine on the politics of the Olympic Games. Daniel Bell is professor of political philosophy at Tsinghua University in Beijing. He's author of China's New Confucianism, Politics and Everyday Life in a Changing Society. Professor Bell, good to have you back on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Do you see what John Hoberman describes as an impenetrable police presence because of the Olympic Games in Beijing?
Well, I think there's tight security, as one might expect, but it's not as oppressive, perhaps, as it might sound. I mean, I just went through the airport yesterday, and it wasn't very tight security. I went going through Israel was infinitely tighter security. So, you know, and I do think that there are legitimate threats to that might be encountered. So, but I mean, to my mind, I mean, I agree though that the Olympics are meant to send a political message. But the question is, what message are they supposed to send? And I think it's not just a matter of China showing its kind of face to the world, saying, look how great we are, we're a great power, we're number one, and so on. I think they're also trying to send a message of that they want to be integrated in the world, and that they want to show a positive face. And I think this will be manifest somewhat in the opening ceremony, which is quite interesting, because there won't be anything about Marx or Mao, but there'll be many, there'll be some, for example, some quotes from Confucius about one of life's greatest pleasures is to welcome friends from afar. And basically, I mean, it's like opening ceremonies in previous Olympics. They're trying to highlight the parts of national culture that they think are worth showing to the rest of the world, but also the parts that are meant to show a degree of openness. So it's not just an occasion of kind of xenophobic nationalism and so on, as is often portrayed, I think, in the media, but it's rather, I think, an occasion to show that you know, China, I mean, historically has been, in the 20th century anyway, was viewed itself as a weak and vulnerable power, bullied by foreign powers. But this is the time to say, okay, now we're going to get a little bit beyond that. You know, then let's restore these kind of traditional Confucian ways of soft power and setting examples for others, and not just relying on military force and so on.
Again, we're talking with Daniel Bell, a professor at Tsinghua University in Beijing. And I need to tell our listeners that Professor Bell has agreed to stay up at, or to be awake at least, at 2 o'clock in the morning, Beijing time. And, Professor, I want to thank you especially for doing that. And, very kind of you. But let me ask you this. When you say that China wants integration, wants to emphasize soft power as opposed to the military, obviously what we have seen in Tibet would seem to contradict that, the crackdown on dissidents that's been reported similarly, and now controls they've put on the Internet for even for Western reporters. Have they violated the conditions of the agreement they made with the IOC?
Well, I'm not sure of the exact agreement that they made with the IOC, but basically there are two main political traditions in China. One is, we can call it the legalist tradition, and this is when China is weak, and as I mentioned, throughout most of the 20th century, it viewed itself as weak and vulnerable. So the main task was to build up this strong state and to rely on harsh punishment to do so, and mobilize the people and not allow for any dissent and so on. And that face is still there. It's still very much part of China today, and we see it locking up dissidents and so on. You know, but then there's this other face, and this is the Confucian face, and that can only show itself once China feels more self-confident and less vulnerable. And I think part of what the Olympics can contribute in China is to give it a kind of self-confidence, and that would allow for this kind of this soft power to manifest itself. But I think if China views itself as constantly under attack by the rest of the world, and every tiny little thing that goes wrong, and there's so many reports on the pollution in Beijing, you know, and so on, then it'll be more defensive, and these traditional kind of ways, you know, whereby it views itself as weak and vulnerable and subject to bully by foreign powers and so on, it's that side will show itself.
So you see the Olympics then not necessarily as being transformative, but as helping the Chinese or encouraging the Chinese to emphasize one part of their tradition over another.
Yeah, well, I think it could transform. Well, it is transformative to a certain extent in the sense that, that it's this chance for China to show that now we are powerful, we have our kind of, you know, what's viewed as a kind of deserved place in the sun, and we no longer have to be so defensive. And but the problem is, if there are so many attacks from the West, and if there are terrorist attacks, you know, in China, then it'll be hard for this relaxation to take place, and for this softer traditional Confucian ways to reassert themselves.
John Hoberman, back to you at the University of Texas at Austin. What about that? Might the Olympics then have a beneficial impact on China?
It's possible. I mean, I think Professor Bell's point about the Chinese sense of vulnerability is very well taken. Orville Schell, the China expert, has a cover story in Newsweek this week on that very subject, and I found that very enlightening. At this point, you know, we do not know in advance what the effects of this Olympiad are going to be on the internal politics of China. One thing you know about an Olympics is that unpredictable things are going to happen, and it may be quite a while before political scientists can look back or sports historians look back and try to assess what actually happened. It's a very complicated business.
Daniel Bell, are you saying that Western reporters in particular are emphasizing too much the downside, if you will, of the Beijing Olympics and of Chinese society, and that that's going to have an effect in itself?
Well, it seems to me some of it, you know, is not just a matter of excessive security. I mean, China wants to put on a good face for visitors, which is kind of natural. I mean, if I have visitors from afar in my home, I'm going to clean up and tidy my room and so on. And it's not necessarily as sinister and totalitarian as it's often portrayed. And so I think there's a part of perhaps what, you know, what my grandmother would say, kind of this constant kvetching, which is a bit excessive at times, and I think makes the Chinese more defensive than they would otherwise be. You know, I mean, and it's not just the government that is proud of the Olympics. I mean, I think most Chinese people in Beijing, for example, where I'm based, are proud too, as far as I could tell. And it is inconvenient in many ways, but, you know, but many people say, well, it's worth putting up for a couple of weeks for this kind of inconvenience.
Again, Daniel Bell is professor of political philosophy at Tsinghua University in Beijing. We're going to have to go to a break in just a minute or so, but I want to introduce our next guest, who's Philip Penn. He formerly was Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post. He's going to Moscow next time around. He himself is second-generation Chinese. He's author of Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. And in the minute or so remaining before we go to our break, Philip Penn, how authoritarian, how successful is the authoritarianism in China? To what extent is there resistance at various levels?
Well, I think there's certainly resistance, but I also think that this is probably one of the most successful authoritarian states in the world right now. You know, you've had 20, 30 years of very strong economic growth, and they've really basically managed to merge capitalism with authoritarianism and stay in power, which is a feat on itself.
It is indeed. And thanks for that sort of a topic sentence for where we're going next on our program. We will continue with our current guest. We'll also talk with Michael Webb, an architecture writer based in Los Angeles, about the extraordinary monumental architecture going up in Beijing. On Reporter's Notebook, should the case of the anthrax letters be closed without more public disclosure? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today again about the promises and the realities of the Beijing Olympics, scheduled to begin at the end of this week. We're talking now with Philip Penn, formerly Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post, author of Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China, where he talked with Chinese people all over the country about their views of their country. Just before we get to that, Philip Penn, what about John Hoberman's comment earlier that the attack today in the western part of the country, which killed quite a few policemen, is it possible that could have been staged by the government?
Well, it's possible, but I think it's most likely there was an incident out there, and I don't think it was staged. We don't have any evidence that it was staged. We have, in fact, on the contrary, you know, consistent number of reports over the past several years of various violent incidents. I think the risk is that the government will overreact to this, and tighten controls even more tightly in that province where the attacks occurred. And the Uyghur minority there basically is a Muslim minority. The government has restricted their right to practice religion and some of their cultural rights as well. And this is a response. These kinds of attacks are a response to that. So if we see another crackdown, I think we might see even more attacks as a result.
Back to what you said earlier about this being one of the most successful authoritarian states in the world right now, and the fact that that has been merged with entrepreneurial capitalism is an extraordinary achievement. Tell us a little bit about how the Olympics look to Chinese people, and do they see this as a situation now where there are promises that were made that aren't being fulfilled, or do they just have a completely different view of what's going on?
Well, I think most Chinese people are very proud of this moment. I agree with Daniel Bell that people are very proud of to be hosts of these games. They're proud of the country's achievements over the past 20 years. But I think the government has a slightly different take. They want to use these games to bolster their own legitimacy, their own authority. And I think they also want to use it to prove to the world that this political system, that a one-party political system with capitalism, is legitimate. And I think this is the message they want to send to their own population.
What does their own population know about alternative systems at this point?
Well, I think there's a lot of information out there about alternative systems. You know, that China is a much freer place than it used to be. And I think one result of that is you have people across the country pushing for political change, not necessarily a straight path to democracy, but in different ways they're pushing for greater media rights, greater civil rights. And I think, we have basically a struggle underway for the future of the country between those who would like to see the status quo remain the same and others who are pushing for change.
Is democracy a goal? There's a lot of criticism of democracy, isn't there, even among those people who know the most about it?
Yes, democracy certainly has been tarnished over the past several years, in part because of the actions of the United States and the results of democratic transitions being messy in other parts of the world. But I do think that when the authoritarian state infringes on people's rights, when it tears down their homes or begins to regulate their ability to have children, or people find it impossible to stop a factory from being built in their neighborhood that is going to pollute the air and the water, people then realize that democratic institutions are the only way to resist that. And I think you have growing pressure across the country for that. I think we have this assumption in the West that capitalism is going to lead automatically to political change, that once income levels reach a certain point, political change will just happen. But in my experience over the past 7 years, I think political change is the result of struggle, of sacrifice, of difficult decisions made by really extraordinary individuals.
Did you say there's a movement on behalf of media rights, civil rights, and other kinds of liberation or liberalization, I guess would be a better term. Excuse me for that. Did the Chinese people, do you think, expect more of that as a result of getting the Olympic Games and being able to host them?
Well, I'm not sure about the direct correlation to the Olympics, but I do think that's one possible result of the Olympics in terms of the engagement with the rest of the world, is that expectations will be higher, that people will expect more from their government, that they'll want the government to behave in a different way. And in fact, we've already seen people from across the country traveling to Beijing, trying to get into Beijing to file their complaints about the abuses of power by local officials. The government so far has responded by preventing them from coming in, by detaining them, by showing the tough side of the government. And so I don't know what's going to be the end result. So far, I think the Olympics have had a backwards effect on the political situation in China.
Again, Philip Pan is author of Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. He has been the Washington Post bureau chief in Beijing for some years. Let's talk a bit about the architecture. Michael Webb is based in Los Angeles. He's an architectural writer. He was the guest editor of the July issue of Architectural Review magazine, which has some extraordinary pictures and diagrams and drawings of the new architecture in Beijing. We've all seen pictures of it. Michael Webb, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Obviously, this great stadium, the Bird's Nest, so-called, and this massive tower, the CCTV building, have gotten the most attention. How would you describe them as ways of making the some of the points that we've heard already on this program?
Well, both are, and I would add the airport, which is the world's yes. largest building and certainly the most impressive airport, I think, in the world, that those three buildings are among the most discussed in the world today. They were each done by a top European firm to the very highest standards, and clearly, they're in the tradition of the Great Wall and the Forbidden City as monuments created by the administration to glorify itself, to glorify the country, and to just knock the socks off everybody who sees them.
Have you seen them? Do they, in fact, knock your socks off?
Yes, they do. I would say a benign rather than a malign way, because there are plenty of monuments in the world that are intimidating and overpowering. And you'd think that a 13 million square foot airport would be intimidating and something that you'd shy away from rather than be drawn to. But it's, at least when I flew through it, one of the most pleasurable and easy experiences of any airport I've been to. And even though it's so huge, it looks as though it's about to fly away. It's an extraordinary job of engineering and architecture, and I think it justifies certainly the ambitions of the authorities and for all of the human cost, both in terms of people displaced and the people who worked under very arduous circumstances to build it in 4 years. Nonetheless, it's a lasting achievement, and it will go down in history.
We'll all be seeing events in the Bird's Nest, the stadium, at another enormous building. First of all, why is it called the Bird's Nest, if you will? And then secondly, do you think it's well adapted for the purpose it was designed for?
The architects, Herzog de Meuron, who are based in Basel in Switzerland, are very much control freaks, most serious architects are, and everything that they do is very precise and controlled, but also very inventive. They were matched up with Ai Weiwei, who's an artist, an agent provocateur, an extraordinary individual whom I had the pleasure of meeting, and he encouraged them to break loose, not to do business as usual, another beautifully tailored stadium, but something that was much looser. And indeed, the notion of the Bird's Nest grew out of the discussions that they had. And then, of course, it was a huge challenge to the engineers to realize this. And they used something like 23 miles of steel beams to frame it. It is, as far as I could tell, all I saw was an early trial, so I have no idea how it'll perform this week for the events. But I would suspect very well. The sight lines are terrific. The very easy access to it.
When we're talking about the Olympics as reflecting all that is good about China, at least from the standpoint of the government, the people that ordered the buildings, how do Chinese architects in particular feel about the fact that it was European architects who got the main jobs?
Well, the fact is there aren't any Chinese architects who could design these buildings at this time. They certainly will be able to, but the traditional way, certainly during the communist period, is for qualified architects, once they've qualified, to join a huge state institute and to grind out factories or schools or party buildings or apartment buildings, whatever, not to have very much freedom of invention. Now, in the last 11 years, there have been a number of small firms established, sometimes very small, just a few individuals in a room, and they have already made extraordinary progress, but they're not in the league of Norman Foster, who has an office of 1,200 people and has built airports and major buildings for 40 years around the world. So the Chinese want the best, and they want it quickly, and the best way of doing that is to go to these foreign architects. But then they match them up with the design institutes, so the Chinese do the working drawings and learn a great deal and, in fact, benefit from the experience. So it's very much a collaboration. And in China, these buildings, the stadium, the airport, are credited to the Chinese partners, not to the Western architects. So a lot of Chinese probably believe that the Beijing Institute of Architecture and Design did the stadium.
You said they reflected the traditions of the past with the Great Wall and the Forbidden City, the monumental architecture of past regimes. What do they reflect that's new, particularly in the context that we have been speaking about politics and culture now?
They're bold. They are daring. They press the limits in terms of structure and form. They're one of a kind. It's like the Sydney Opera House, which I think redefined Australia to the world. The Eiffel Tower, which was much criticized at the time it was built in the late 19th century, is now the most familiar emblem of Paris. Buildings stick around for centuries. The games are over in 2 weeks. Putting your money into buildings is a very good investment for any regime, and most of all for one that wants to project an image of wealth and power and confidence around the world.
Michael Webb, again, based in Los Angeles, a guest editor of the July issue of Architectural Review magazine, which focuses on the architecture in Beijing. Let me go back to our other guests. First to John Hoberman at the University of Texas in Austin, who wrote The Olympic Myth, What the Olympics May Do More Harm Than Good, or Why, excuse me, the Olympics Might Do More Harm Than Good. Interested in your reflection on what we just heard, that these buildings are going to be around for a long time to come. That certainly will be a legacy of this Olympics.
Right, and Hitler's Olympic Stadium in Berlin stands to this day, and of course has been put to much more civilized uses than it once was. I mean, the Olympic movement raises the whole issue of monumentalism in a very fundamental way. The kinds of mass gymnastics exhibitions, tremendous numbers of people, tremendous control, tremendous coordination, tremendous symbolic value to a dictatorship. This is a certain kind of monumentalism that has long been associated, at least in this century, with the human body as something that is disciplined and politically symbolic. Susan Sontag wrote her essay Fascinating Fascism about this 30 years ago. So the problem with monumentalism is that it can take on a totalitarian quality, an intimidating quality. Interestingly, Mr. Webb says that these are monuments that, in his judgment, do not intimidate, that are more receptive. And they may, in fact, hopefully in a more democratic Chinese future, be seen as pioneering aesthetic creations that are the right sort of monumentalism as opposed to the more malign kind of monumentalism.
Daniel Bell, still with us at an early hour at Tsinghua University in Beijing. You teach at Tsinghua University, people who are going to be part of the ruling elite. I'm just very interested in your take on what we've been hearing.
Sorry, you're very interested in my take on what?
On what we have been hearing about just about from our last two speakers.
Right. Well, there's one thing that the second to last speaker said, which surprised me a little bit, about how most Chinese think that the Chinese designed those monumental buildings. That's not my impression at all. I mean, I think it's quite clear in the press and at least among the people that I talk to that they're designed by foreigners, and that was a subject of controversy, especially with respect to the which wasn't mentioned, the kind of the egg-shaped music symphony hall next to Tiananmen Square. But I think that part of those buildings are meant to symbolize also that, again, that China wants to be integrated in the global system, and it's not just they're not just projecting this idea of national power and pride. So that's one thing. The other thing, I mean,
if I may interrupt you, how do the buildings help to integrate China into the rest of the world?
Oh, because I think, as mentioned, most Chinese are aware that their is by the fact that they're done by foreign architects shows the benefits of being integrated in the global system and how we could learn from it and improve our own country by being integrated in this way. And they have a few Chinese characteristics, like the airport. The roof is in the shape of the scales of a dragon, and so on. But it's symbolic, and clearly it's foreign inspired. And I also agree with a view that you don't get this sense of a kind of, it's a totalitarian monument that dwarfs the individual. I mean, especially the airport, you feel that it's almost part of the outdoors. And I think it was beautifully put that it looks like it's about to fly away. Yeah. But the other point that I was about to make about the political direction of China, I mean, there's this assumption that, you know, China is either going to be authoritarian or democratic. And I think this is one of the dichotomies that I think we have to question. And I think this return to Confucianism especially opens up new options that don't fit neatly into either category. I don't think anybody in China, including the ruling class, thinks that the status quo is here to stay. It's just a matter of time in terms of when it's going to change, and everybody believes that it's going to change in substantial ways. But it won't necessarily look like Western-style democracy. And that's, you know, some of the Confucian ideas about meritocracy, for example, I think are very important and taken very seriously now in political debates, which are actually more open, especially in universities, than what most people might think on the outside.
Philip Penn, back to you. Does that reflect what you found when you were talking to ordinary Chinese around the country?
Yes, I don't think the whatever model that China eventually embraces is going to be a duplicate of the American system. I think, you know, if they move in a more democratic direction, they'll definitely have its own cultural background. But I also think that the argument that that there's a lot of debate about this is wrong. I do think that, especially in the state media, you know, it's still very taboo to discuss any future in which the party is not in control. The party, would like to see perhaps an evolution of the state, but the end result for them continues to be the party being in power. And so far, they've managed to pull it off.
And Michael Webb, back to our architectural writer, certainly the monumental architecture we're talking about would have the effect, one would think, of impressing the people who are subject to the government that constructed it.
Well, I think that they're impressed by those images, which are obviously widely published, and even if they haven't seen them in the flesh, they've certainly seen them illustrated and on television. But, of course, the monuments or the foreign work is just a tiny, tiny fraction of the construction boom that is consuming all of China. All the cities are exploding with construction. You know, there are cranes on every skyline. And the buildings are getting larger, more and more of the old is crumbling and being replaced. And so it is the overall impact of new development that is perhaps going to impress or depress ordinary Chinese the most.
China and the Olympics, of course, we'll be talking about it as the days go by. Thank you all very much for being with us today. Michael Webb, again, the guest editor in July of the Architectural Review magazine on the new architecture in Beijing. Philip Penn, author of Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. He with the Washington Post. Daniel Bell, again, particularly thanks to you for staying up so late in China, a professor of political philosophy at Tsinghua University. His book, China's New Confucianism, Politics and Everyday Life in a Changing Society. And John Hoberman, at the University of Texas at Austin, author in Foreign Policy magazine of the article questioning the benefits of the Olympic Games. Thanks to all of you very much for being with us. And again, we'll be talking more about the Olympics in the days to come. Since Friday, we've all been reminded about the 7 anthrax-laced letters that killed 5 people, injured 17, and stoked fears of a new wave of terror just shortly after September 11th. Now the FBI reportedly is about to close the case, having concluded that the prime suspect committed suicide last week. But not everybody is satisfied that all the evidence is in, as we'll hear in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Stephen Hatfill is a government scientist who was recently identified or publicly identified as a person of interest in the anthrax letters case. The FBI even took reporters along when they raided his home. Since then, though, the government settled a lawsuit that Hatfill brought for $5 million. Now, the focus is on the late Bruce Ivins, who also worked at the Army's Biological Research Lab at Fort Detrick, Maryland. Ivins allegedly committed suicide last week because he learned he was about to be indicted. One of the offices that got an anthrax-laced letter was that of Tom Daschle, the former Democratic leader in the U.S. Senate. And here is what he has to say about the possibility that the FBI might be closing the case.
I think they haven't been as forthcoming, not only with me, but with the American people, about the status of this investigation. I also haven't seen the evidence, and I think that given their checkered past and the difficulty that they had in getting to this point, the bungling of the Hatfield part of the investigation leads me to be very skeptical.
Again, Tom Daschle, former leader of the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, a senator from South Dakota. Glenn Greenwald is a constitutional law attorney. He's a contributing writer at Salon.com. His latest book is Great American Hypocrites. Glenn Greenwald, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Warren.
What about the Hatfield case, and what is it that you can tell about the current situation with Dr. Ivins that would lead us to believe the FBI more than they deserve to be believed in the case of Dr. Hatfield?
I don't think any rational person is in a position right now to say that they believe the FBI or believe the accusations against Bruce Ivins. I think it's absolutely critical to note that there has been zero evidence presented by the Justice Department or by the FBI, and really by any of these media accounts that are all but convicting Bruce Ivins, based upon innuendo and leaks of the type that was used for years to wrongfully accuse Stephen Hatfield. And so I think in general, it's a very good practice not to believe serious government allegations without seeing evidence. But in this particular case, where Senator Daschle said there's nothing but a history of one extreme example of ineptitude after the next over a course of 7 years, it would be incredibly foolish to believe that the FBI has the right person here without seeing conclusive, convincing evidence that links him to these crimes.
One of the issues, as I understand it, is the sort of chemical makeup of the anthrax that was used in the letters or discovered in the letters. Isn't it true that spores of a similar type have been found on a bookcase at a research lab where Bruce Ivins worked? That's one of the things we're seeing reported in the papers. Hard to put it all together, but that's not persuasive?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's numerous people who work at Fort Detrick, and numerous people who have access to all of those strains. Secondly, Bruce Ivins was not a researcher working on an offensive form of anthrax. He wasn't trying to aerialize anthrax or weaponize it. He was working on vaccines against it. And what seems rather clear is that he didn't have access to a high-strain anthrax of the type, the very refined anthrax that was sent, certainly to Senator Daschle, that could kill people just by touching it. And numerous people in that lab have said that it's virtually impossible that he would have the know-how as to how to produce that or that he could access it without being detected. Now, maybe that's not true, but the fact, you know, I think it's been clear from the beginning that the strain of anthrax that was sent to Leahy and Daschle came in some way from the Fort Detrick lab or the Proving Ground in Utah, some government U.S. Army research facility. But the fact that there's residue where they've detected that strain within this lab that many, many people have access to is hardly a reason to conclude that Bruce Ivins is guilty as opposed to any of the other people who work there.
Patrick Leahy of Vermont, another senator whose office received one of the letters with anthrax in it. What about Jean Carroll Dooley? She is the therapist who contended in court that Ivins had come into a group therapy session, said that because of his likely indictment by the FBI, he was going to kill a lot of people. And she filed a request for an order, which was granted, to keep him away from her.
Well, let's for the moment, I think there's a lot of reasons to be questioning her credibility and her claim, certainly as a professional. But let's assume just for the moment that what she said is true. It is completely understandable that somebody who is under the kind of scrutiny that the FBI puts you under when they consider you to be the prime suspect in a case of this type would be undergoing very severe mental instability. I mean, they basically ruined Stephen Hatfield's life. They followed him around. They engaged in very public surveillance. As you said, they took the media with them on many of their searches. They dug through every last minute private detail of his life, and they leaked it to the press. if you're being told or if you find out that you are wrongly being accused and are the lead suspect by the FBI who's tailing you and surveilling you and cutting off your access to your work where you've worked for 18 years, it's certainly reasonable that you would start to exhibit very severe emotional instability and even rage and anger. And in fact, if you're wrongfully accused, I think that anger would probably be even more understandable. So even if you assume that what she's saying is true about the mental condition that he exhibited over the past several months, that by no means is even remotely suggesting that he's the anthrax attacker.
As you said, we probably don't have time to go into the issue of her qualifications or believability, but what do you think needs to be revealed here? What do the American people need to know before the FBI says we're going to close this case?
Well, the first thing is we need to know what the evidence is that links him to the anthrax attacks. We need to know why it is that over the course of 7 years of this investigation, he continued to maintain access to the most dangerous pathogens in this country, if in fact the evidence were really this compelling that he was the anthrax attacker. We need to know what took them down the wrong path, why government sources seem to try to blame this on foreign culprits, the Iraqi government, on everyone except the one who did it, and most of all, we need to see the case laid out before we're convinced that not only that he did it, but that he acted alone and there's nobody else responsible.
Glenn Greenwald, once again, attorney practicing constitutional law, contributing writer at Salon.com. His latest book, Great American Hypocrites. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Warren. Thanks.
Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Cameron Radziner and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Charlton Thorpe. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.